Welcome to Catching Up with Comedians. I'm your host, Rich Stein. Looking for Gene Hamm on the other end of the line.
Hello.
Hey, is this Gene Hamm?
Last I looked, yeah.
From Hammination Studios?
Yep.
Wow, it's great to talk to you. We've had a couple of chats, and I saw you doing a stand-up over at the one of Bert Toplitzky's big venues in L.A. a couple months ago. Remember we had an apple pie at the Apple Pan?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you saw on the gossip columns, it looked like that was one of the last places Matthew Perry was seen publicly. He was there about either a week after we were. Isn't that a weird trip? Hello?
Sorry, I'm still trying. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah. Yeah, you're coming through good.
Oh, good. Yeah, that was a fun night.
I don't think I've ever had a better cup of coffee than at the Apple Pan. Of course, they give you that real cream. That's what makes a difference, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I wanted to kind of, the thing that in our talk over the last, when we had a little bit of a pre-interview, I love the fact that you worked with Art Clokey. That was one of your first gigs in the great Davy and Goliath, Gumby and Pokey guy.
Yeah, I worked on the second time Gumby came around, when Eddie Murphy made him popular again.
Oh yeah, yeah. Forgot about that.
Because about 89, 90s is when I worked. They moved up to Sausalito, and I got turned out my friend Dallas McKinnon, who was my mentor. He was the voice of Gumby. I never knew it. Wow. And he got me the job.
Mm-hmm. Hey, before we get into that, let me hear a little bit about your startup. Because I remember you said it took you about three times. So take us back to graduating high school, and you were from Seaside. Was it Seaside or Astoria that you grew up?
Seaside, Oregon, the town next to it was Astoria.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I graduated high school.
Mm-hmm. And you said it took you three. Go, take us through those three trips down to Hollyweird and how that happened.
Well, in '68, I was in college, and on Christmas vacation, I decided I was going to try to see if I could go down to Hollywood, see if I could get into or get a job. I was too dumb to realize that if it's Christmas vacation, nobody'd be open. So,
right.
So that was a kind of a wasted trip. And then when I came back up in '71, Dallas McKinnon. Well, Dallas McKinnon, he was on a TV show called Daniel Boone, and it was like big news in our small town.
Mm-hmm.
But he lived in Cannon Beach, the next town over,
right.
And it was big news that a TV star had moved to the town.
Wow!
And he kind of took me under his wing. He took me in '71. He took me down to L.A. He was driving down there to. He did voices on a lot of Disney things. Like he was Mary Poppins. He was the voice of the fox that they were chasing.
Mm-hmm.
And to keep awake on the driving down I-5, he taught me how to do voices all the way down on that trip.
Wow.
And when we got down there. I stayed there for a month, still trying to get the work, and I couldn't get work. But he did have me meet a lady named Laverne Harding. She was one of the very first female animators. Mm-hmm. She worked for Walter Lantz, worked on Woody Woodpecker, and she took me to the union, the cartoonist union.
Right.
And I met the head of the cartoonist union. And he told me that nobody was hiring at that. It was like, this was like in February. And he said, nobody hires this time. Come back in the summer. So I, So instead of coming back in the summer, I get married. And so, and, so seven years later, when I, she has enough of me and find somebody else, I decided to, and this is 1978, I decided to try it again. I thought, I got nothing to lose.
Right.
And it turned out that there, I had a friend named Frank Morris. He'd won the Oscar in 1973 for Frank film. And he was nice enough to, the night she left me, I called him up and asked him if he could put me up if I came down. And he and his wife were nice about it. So anyway, while I was up in Oregon, there's a magazine called American Cinematographer.
Right.
And in the back of the magazine, it said that Bakshi was hiring for Lord of the Rings.
Wow.
So I go down there and I get on the phone from Frank Morris's house and I call Bakshi Productions. Mm-hmm. And it's like to speak to personnel. And it says, are you looking for a job? Yes, I am. Oh, we're not hiring. Click. And I, huh? And I thought, what? And then I remembered the union. And so I called the union. And I said, I called Bakshi and they're not hiring. What do you mean they're not hiring? They're hiring anybody that can breathe.
Oh, my God.
And says, who the hell did you talk to? And I said, personnel. You dipshit. You don't talk to personnel. Call Jackie Rocher. She's the hiring. So I called Jackie Rocher. And so basically, I was always terrible on the phone. I was always shy.
Right.
And I'm all getting all ready to try to make a big, long selling speech. To
right.
Before I could get two sentences out, she said, start tomorrow. And so then, after a month, I was in the union, and they can't fire you when you're in the union. So when you go to I went to the different studios, and when I got to Hanna-Barbera, they were working on Smurfs and Super Friends, and they had me take classes at night so they get 30 usable drawings out of me a day. And so I learned everything I didn't learn in art school.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Wow. So Hanna-Barbera paid for that kind of?
Yeah. They had classes at night, and then the students are doing the best. They'd hire them there. Mm-hmm. So
that's great.
So, yeah. So I did get a job at Hanna-Barbera then.
Hmm. Okay. Then was it Joe Hanna and or was it Joe Barbera? I remember.
Hanna and Joe Barbera.
I think like a lot of teams, didn't they kind of have their fights along the way? I mean, it seems like one of them was the more dominant guy. It's just like with the two guys that did Bullwinkle, you know, that one, I remember one guy was the businessman. Who were the two guys that did? Jay Ward was all business, but it was the guy that did Bullwinkle, Bill
Scott.
Bill Scott. He did the voice of Bullwinkle, and he was really the type A personality, the alpha that made everything. But that Jay Ward was a genius. I mean, he was the business guy. He knew how to do that. Were Hanna-Barbera kind of like that? They were kind of, you know, two sides.
Well, Barbera wasn't around when I was there. Hanna was around.
Mm-hmm.
Hanna. Hanna actually talked to me once because every Halloween they had everybody came to work in costumes and at that time we were afraid that there was always rumors that the upstairs of a computer that was going to be taking all our jobs doing painting and stuff, and we were really afraid of that thing. And they're kind of using it to keep us in line, and so I went for costume. I bought a pair of long underwear up top and bottom, and then I got I think about $20 worth of tin foil, and I made a pair of tin foil pants and a tin foil shirt, and a tin foil helmet, and then I painted my face silver, and then I. I went as the Hanna-Barbera computer. And I had an Etch-a-Sketch hanging from my neck and that Hanna-Barbera computer. Mm-hmm. And all day, I was anybody talked to me, I said, "How I am the Hanna-Barbera computer. Mm-hmm. You can draw anything on me. You can draw unemployment."
And so that's cool. That's funny.
So they had a bunch of the people are just trying really sucking up to the management. They mm-hmm. went as the Smurfs. Mm-hmm. And. I think it was the employees there. They voted for the best ones. The Smurf came in first. I came in second.
Mm, that's cool.
So the media was there, and because it made good news story. Mm-hmm. And so as you get the prize, you go up and shake Bill Hanna's hand.
Wow.
And he whispered in my ear, "You son of a bitch."
Uh-huh. Wow. Kind of upstage the Smurfs a little bit.
Yeah.
Wow. And the Smurfs are still
that night. That night, I came in second at Hanna-Barbera, but uh-huh. that night they had a union party, a Halloween party. Uh-huh. I came in first.
There you go. That's the true. That was a true rating. Yeah. When you started describing your outfit, it reminded me of every monster that was ever on Lost in Space. Remember, they always wore a colander, like a spaghetti strainer, on their head. They had for a show that went on for a lot of years, and they had a lot of. They were like Gilligan's Island. They were always in the most form-fitting velour-like costumes, but every monster had a spaghetti strainer on their head. You know.
Yeah.
All right. So, had you been at this point? Had you checked in with Art Clokey yet when you were doing the?
No, this was a Clokey's. I moved up to the North Bay to work there. I was down there about 10 years, and then Dallas McKinnon told me they were hiring up there and so I moved up there.
Okay.
And that was the best job I ever had. I think. Working for somebody else because I call myself the in-house freelancer. The weird thing was that I had, in Hollywood, I had a rent controlled apartment,
right?
And and I had to give up my rent controlled apartment to move up there. So the first day I was there, I think the guy was named Harry Walton was the guy that was actually the directing all the animation there. And
at the Art Clokey place.
Yeah. And, I'll tell you a funny story about Art after this,
okay.
but the Harry Walton, the very first job he gave me, assignment he gave me, was this chicken flying through a window. and the hardest shot you can possibly imagine, because you got all these wires and you got to ping them so they vibrate so they don't leave an image, you know, so it doesn't look, you don't see the wires for every frame. Uh-huh. It took me till Wednesday to finish that shot. And that's sure, you sure got that done on the first day. And
right.
So I was scared I was going to lose the job.
Right.
On Wednesday, I was with them when they always had a volleyball game after work,
okay.
And I was right next to this guy on the front of the volleyball. We're jumping for a ball, and we were all both up in the air, and he came down with his elbow and broke my rib, and first time I ever broke a bone. And so then I went. I was out of work
because that's isn't that the most painful bone you can break? Or it's like,
oh yeah,
I've heard that it's like because you can't, they can't set it in a cast or anything.
No. And you roll over and sleep, and it never hurts unless you breathe.
That's what Jack Nicholson said in Chinatown. So how long did it take you to? Had to take you a good month or 6 weeks to get over that.
Well, probably took me, yeah. But but basically, since I was out of work and I had no apartment, I went to work every single day, and they had this thing called a pencil test system, a kind of a video thing. Mm-hmm. And so I just was visibly working to get myself better at doing the animation to prove I could get back in there. In the meantime, I overhear that I think it was Art was actually talking to somebody that lost or they couldn't figure out how to animate the water coming out of the Mastodon's nose, the trunk. Mm-hmm. They tried real water, and real water didn't look like real water. Mm-hmm. And I had to remember, I was in Big Brother for 10 years down in L.A. Mm-hmm. And one time, this guy that did Curious George, he did a stop-motion short with Curious George, and it was a fireman that adopted Curious George. So they had, so the guy was showing us how he did it, and he had on the fire hose, he had a saran wrap on a wire, and when you give it a little twist, each frame it looks like water. Mm-hmm. So I did a test on the I had him give me the Mastodon. I drilled a hole in the trunk and put a wire in there, and then they made me the special effects animator.
Wow.
And then I overheard that the sound reader, the guy who's writing home exposure sheets, he got a better job. So I said, I can do that. So anytime they needed somebody, I can do it. So I made myself indispensable. Right. And then Dallas came up down. Every once in a while, he'd come down to record some more voices. He was the voice of Gumby and a bunch of other characters. And he said, Gene can do voices. So he had me do voices on about half the films. In fact, I was Gumby's teacher. That was my regular character.
Cool. Yeah, there was always something about when I was a kid. I know they had that air of, I think you said once they were somehow connected with the Lutheran church, but some of those early
David and Goliath. Yeah.
But that was Clokey, right? That was him.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about the funny story I want to tell you was the original Gumby. It was a spinoff of the Howdy Doody show, and it got really popular, so it got its own show. Oh. And Art's first wife. He was partners with her. Mm-hmm. And right in the middle of the first season, this is about the 60s, you know, so Art discovered LSD. And then he wasn't doing a thing. His wife had to do all the shows. Mm-hmm. And Gumby used to have a dog whose name Nopi. And the dog would never do anything. Like he'd never come. Gumby would say something to it, and they'd look at it and go, nope. But the thing was that the dog was not created by Art. It was created by Art's wife because the dog was Art. Because when you have an idea, you pitch it to him, you go, nope. I remember the first day when I first met Art, I said, my favorite character is Nopi. Is he in the show? Nope.
Yeah. So he got rid of the wife and got rid of Nopi, huh?
Yeah, he had a second wife. His second wife was nicer. Her name was Gloria. Art and her and Gloria were really nice people.
That's cool, yeah. Did he maintain his LSD affiliation for a while?
No, I think he was really into Eastern meditation and stuff.
That's what the Beatles did. You know, you get on, try some acid, then you try some Eastern meditation.
Yeah, they find out you don't need all the external stuff; it's already inside you. If you find it,
I like listening. I still listen to some of George Harrison's. They've got a lot of stuff online about stuff he said, and he was pretty, for the quiet Beatle, I think in many ways he was the seeker, you know, of the Beatle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was pretty enlightened.
So at this time you were you were working the Art Clokey thing, and what and did you stay with that organ? You said it was PermaVision. Is that was his company
they,
name?
They called him PermaVision. P-R-E-M-A Vision.
So how long did you stay with that operation, would you say?
Well, the series lasted 2 years, so I was there for 2 years. And then I kind of went out to, I worked for Sega doing some video games. And I did the Living Books. So they had some interactive books where you click on stuff and it'll trigger some animation. And then I taught animation at Academy of Art for about 10 or 15 years off and on. And now I'm doing my own stuff too. Right now I've got my animated feature Hell Toupee, T-O-U-P-E-E, is on Tubi. The plot is the very first the world's first genetically engineered living toupee.
Yeah, I watched that movie. I thought it was hilarious. I watched it from the time we met at that gig you did for Bert. I went home and I watched it. I just think animation is so, I mean, I had a daughter late in life. I was 50. And so I got to see a whole second generation of shows. Have you ever heard of a show called The Amazing World of Gumball?
Gumball?
I mean, yeah. No. The Amazing World. I always call it, let me think.
No.
World of Gumball. I mean, they're, you know, it's like even there's even some musicians, like she's 18 now and I'm 68, so she's listening to this guy Hozier. He's like an English musician. He's been on SNL. She's going to go see him at Carnegie Hall, and it's kind of enlightening and fulfilling to know that, you know, because I still listen to my Beatles and all my classic bands, but if you listen to this guy, I mean, he is, his famous song is "Take Me to Church." Da 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 da. I mean, when you hear some of these, she has so many musicians that she follows, and I listen to them when we're driving the car. They go, "Oh, these guys are really good. I mean, really good." So this, do me a favor and do yourself a favor. This is a show called The Amazing World of Gumball. Now, Gumball is like I'm trying to think what he even is. He's like a balloon, and his brother is like a fish who lives out of water. That's his name. And then the parents are just like every character in the cartoon is something that could never even be in the real world walking around, you know, as a balloon, there's a rainbow. And the parents are like, the father's just this clueless guy. I think he's like a big donut or something. I'm telling you, it's just like Bullwinkle from our era was arguably one of the greatest cartoons because it was for kids, but it was also for adults. And for my money, The Simpsons, SpongeBob, and even Family Guy, I mean, it's great. It's in the world we live in now that is so dark and so evil. I mean, Family Guy, there's nobody funnier to me than Peter Griffin when he lays it out. You know, he just lays out what's really happening in the world. So,
yeah, I think the best things are where they don't talk down to kids. Where they, the cartoons I grew up on, like Bugs Bunny, when I first saw it, I could understand all the physical gags, but then as you got older, then you could understand all the verbal gags, all the things that are satirizing and stuff.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Mel Blanc was a one-man army. I mean, without, there would have been no Looney Tunes, I guess you could say, without, I mean, he was so ubiquitous, he did thousands of voices, you know, and he put the, remember he even did once, he did the voice of something sneezing, and you could just tell that it was, and then there's, the guy I was trying to think about the other day when we talked was Frank Welker.
Oh,
Frank Welker, because he, I think he did the burp on Elf for when Will Ferrell burped, because he's the guy, he doesn't just do, he does animal voices, and he just does weird, strange sounds that, you know, the sound of a whale farting or whatever. It's Frank Welker's the guy, and I think he's still alive. I think he is. I mean, he's he did kind of, you know, he's, I could look him up. I've got your page open on IMDb right now if we want to bounce a few things back, but you've heard of him, right? I mean, he's done a million voices over the years, and sounds, that's what his expertise is. He just does any sound you need. Frank Welker's the guy.
Yeah, he's kind of like what Dallas McKinnon was, my mentor. He started off just imitating. He lived on a farm. He imitated all the farm animals, and then he got around to human voices.
He must have been the guy that did all the voices on the Speak and Spell. Remember?
Could have been. Yeah. Well, when he went to Disneyland, when he got on the Runaway Mine train, his voice was the one of "Fasten your seatbelts."
Nah. Hey, did you ever run across Thurl Ravenscroft?
I think he was gone before I came down there.
The Grinch guy.
Yeah.
I noticed they have Hugh Grant playing him in the new Jerry Seinfeld movie. Hugh Grant is a really good actor, but he was actually playing Thurl Ravenscroft.
Because I think Thurl was also Tony Tiger.
Yeah, he did the Tony Tiger voice. Yeah, but he played it. I watched it last night. He played it really, as a kind of a pithy guy who wasn't really, he was just mailing it in, so to speak. But yeah, Thurl Ravenscroft, the reason I taught high school down in San Juan Capistrano for 12 years, and he ended up, I always thought he must have been a smoker at one point to have, but some people just to have a register that low. But he ended up narrating the Pageant of the Masters for the last, 15 or 20 years of his life because he had that voice. You know, the thing in Laguna Beach where they kind of, they do these paintings. They have all these people that I don't know if you ever heard of it, but the Sawdust Festival, all these people act and they do stuff where they're standing to kind of simulate what famous paintings look like. Anyway, you talk about having a guy who would be a narrator that could really have a crowd come in. You know, I mean, he commanded your attention just by his voice. So.
Huh. You're talking about Grant playing as somebody who's kind of aloof.
Yeah.
So, do you remember that I guess it was in the 80s, the very first thing that Jim Carrey did was a thing called the Duck Factory.
Sure, I do remember that was a...
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't go, but I think it went a year, but,
It only lasted a few months, but the thing was, he played the... Actually, they didn't know what to do with him because he was like straight man. Everybody else was a stooge in that thing.
Okay.
But they had the overworked, underpaid animator, the old guy, and then they had a guy that was writing the things, and he hated writing it because he was doing the Great American Novel, and it didn't do well in the rest of the country. Right. But at the Cartoonist Union, we thought it was a documentary.
I think it did. I was just telling somebody yesterday. I forgot. Maybe it was. The first thing that somebody does, it's like Letterman's first show went on in 1980, a day show, it bombed, and he was kicking chairs backstage. You thought he was done in the business forever. But it's like burning the first card in the deck after you shuffle it. You got to get that on. Jim, I booked Jim Carrey in a room in 1989. I booked him for $400 in San Diego. Uh-huh. And
wow.
He came down, and I even talked to Jimmy Miller, who was his agent, Dennis Miller's brother.
Hmm.
And he said, well, he's got to make more money than the other guys. And I it was weird. If, 1989, that was like a couple of years into my career, and I'm negotiating with Jimmy Miller. And all the Miller boys have the same exact voice as Dennis Miller. It's that same exact voice. Rich Miller was another brother who booked comedy, and he was the nicest of all of them, and he used to book me at like Sammy's by the Shore and Marina Del Rey and stuff like that. But anyway, Jimmy Miller, so he drives down in his Volkswagen Bug, and he goes up, and he used to do a thing when he came up, whoever the MC was. I saw him do it with Louie Anderson. He'd go, Louie Anderson, everybody, Louie Anderson. But then he would go on for like 2 minutes with this. So he did it with me. I mean, I'm still kicking myself. I had a video camera at that time, but I was concentrating on the show because they paid me a nice little chunk of dough. Because I'd been doing this weekly show for about, half a year. And the guy said, if I give you couple of thousand dollars, could you bring some bigger names down? I think we could work that out. So just to get Jim Carrey at that time, I think he was a couple months from In Living Color, because the Living Color was 90 and we did this in 89. So I bring him up. He goes, Rich Stein, everybody. He had never even met me. Rich Stein, everybody, give it up again. I was dying laughing. I was laughing so hard. But, I mean, he was and still is. He's kind of gone spiritual now. And, I mean, he, you know, he's, when you're worth $500 million, it's little, takes a little bit of the pressure off when you're. But nobody worked harder than that guy. I mean, that guy put everything he had. I mean, I think he ruined his back playing the Grinch, which is another Thurl Ravenscroft part. But, yeah, he came down. He did 20 minutes. He just destroyed. He destroyed in a room for 20 minutes and made $400, which, you know, at the time was pretty good chunk of dough for 20 minutes. But when you consider – but I've always heard good things about the Duck Factory, and it's kind of a shame that – But I'm trying to think, there were, was that guy from Alf, the guy who played the father on Alf, was he the guy that was one of the, and then I think, not, now Lauren Hutton was in Once Bitten, that was his first movie that didn't do that great, but it was, I think it was pretty good. Yeah, I think they had a big repertoire of people in the Duck Factory, you know, and the concept was good, but yeah, did it not even went one season, right? It only
lasted about 6 or 8 episodes.
Yeah.
We in the cartoonist unions recognized every character in there. But there's somebody really in the studio. but you're talking about I used to hang out at the improv in the 80s,
right.
And I remember Andy Kaufman was in the hall between the bar and the club part. And he was talking to somebody, and I wondered, like, what would he be talking about? Kind of, so I kind of got close to him to hear what the conversation was. Mm-hmm. They're having Andy Kaufman was having a very deep conversation about transcendental meditation
with just some other person.
I don't know who the other person was. Mm-hmm. Just really very serious conversation. Wow.
Yeah, he was like one of those guys who, when he was on stage, boy, he left it all on the stage. You didn't know what he was going to do. And I give him a lot of credit for creating that. What was the name of that guy he created who was just a big...
Oh, Tony Clifton.
Tony Clifton. That was hilarious. That was freaking hilarious. I got it on good authority that Rodney Dangerfield hired... Because Rodney, nobody had a harder career than him. He quit, came back 12 years later. He would just die laughing that Kaufman had enough balls to go up on stage and literally just have the audience hate him, just revile him as this Tony Clifton. I've heard other comics say that Rodney would just stand in the back of the room and just howl because it was, you know, when Rodney had a lot of hard times coming up, and just to be able to watch a younger kid do commit to a character like that, he hired him just for that reason, so he could watch him.
I think the thing of what Kaufman did, there was kind of a few people kind of doing stuff in that vein, with Steve Martin a little bit, I can't remember the other guy but he invented, it was like playing a practical joke on the audience.
Very brave. Most comics don't want to hear that silence. That's what a lot of comics, like Steve Martin, is. Have you watched his new documentary yet?
Not yet.
I started it because I'm a real delayed gratification guy. I love it so much that he's narrating the whole thing. I think it's two parts, so it's nice and long. It shows all the old video of him doing magic in the magic shop of the Disneyland and doing Knott's Berry Farm. And he's narrating the whole thing. They took a lot of time. They put a lot of clips in it. It's really, so I've only watched maybe a quarter of it because I'm really going to stretch it out. But that's what he talks about. He actually went to Long Beach State to take a philosophy class and to take a class about psychology, because he said anybody, all these old comics that were doing the Take My Wife Please and the Ladies and Germs, they were doing a patter where the patter of the timing of the comedy gets the laugh. Da 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 and you're all just laughing because you're laughing because you really are being swept over by how funny this shit is. And it's just you and these guys, your old friends. Like, I get together with my old high school friends. We go to Myrtle Beach and play golf. I'm going to see a bunch of them this. And we grew up together. We did all the bullshit together you do when you're in third grade and then fifth grade. So you just, you know, all you got to do is say a couple of words, you know, and you laugh. It's true laughter and pleasure as opposed to just laughing off the beat of a punchline. So,
you know,
he's exploring all that. And that's what he explored. And he wanted to make people laugh like that. That's why he had the arrow through the head and all that shit, you know.
Well, he also said in his book that his autobiography about right. be so good they can't ignore you. And
right, he repeats that in the documentary. Yeah, I've got that book on my shelf. Anything somebody like him says.
But there's you brought up the point about being funny with your friends.
Mm-hmm.
I saw some interviews with George Carlin, and then he was talking about how people when they're funny with their friends, as at some points one of their friends go, you got to go up on stage and do that, and they go up on stage and they die and they can't figure out why, and the thing is that they don't bring the context because they bring the punchline, but they didn't bring the setup.
That's true. Sure. Yep.
And so George Carlin, he started out, he had a partner. I think it was, I forgot who the partner was.
Jack Burns.
Yeah. But he was doing all the writing. Mm-hmm. And then when they broke up, then he had to figure, cause he was, Burns was the straight man. Yeah, and he was the stooge. Mm-hmm. So he had to figure out. He took in all the material with him and figure out how to do it as a single.
Right.
So basically, he had to do both parts. So he had to kind of argue with himself. Like, you might think that then here comes the punchline.
Mm-hmm. George Carlin is his own entity, and you know he should have a shrine. I've read all of his books, his posthumous books. I've watched and listened and gone over all of his albums. I met him once, and we had a nice little interaction in Vegas. And yeah, he's I always say Richard Pryor is probably the funniest for when you bend over and belly, when you watching people in an audience bending over at their waist and spitting out because he was so funny. But George Carlin was the funniest in the terms of the intellectual, just the A quality of all of his material, and still funny too, because he started out. Rich Scheidner does a history of comedy show. Rich Scheidner is a 35, 40 year comedian. He does a comedy history show where he takes on all the stuff from Mom's Mabel. He takes it all through, and he explains how George Carlin is the only comedian of the modern era who had four distinctive phases of his career. And then when you hear him, I've watched it twice. He's always evolving this history show. He's performing it right now in where he lives, which is Asheville, North Carolina. But it's called The History of Comedy. I can send you the little link of it. It shows Lenny Bruce. But he talks about how Carlin, you know, he started out. If you ever heard his first album, Takeoffs and Put-Ons, it was just him doing voices. And he'd be, he was just doing sounds and voices and impressions, and he would do like, here is Marjorie Congolium on the game show, and here she is, and she's the winner of, you know, and he would take off on the Queen for a Day. He did, and that's what Lenny Bruce, that's what all the old comedians did. You start out doing impressions, you do takeoffs on TV shows, and then, you know, he became the suit and tie guy, then he was the hippie guy, and then the last phase was where he was really... You know, he was holding no prisoners, man. He put it all in. And now that the country is circling the drain, a lot of the younger generation is finding some of those clips where he talked about the government is not your friend. You know, they don't give a shit about you. They don't give a shit about me. You know, a lot of the younger generation say, hey, this guy knew what the hell he was talking about. You think?
Yeah. Well, he was also, I bought three of his books, and he came up here to I was living in Petaluma, California, and he came to the bookstore. He autographed all three of his books. He's just a hell of a sweet guy in person.
Yeah, he really is. He always said that he didn't really like to be. He wasn't a crowd guy, you know. He liked being in his own head, and he was very. I remember he went up at a comedy awards show once, and he said, "You know, Joe Piscopo's a nice enough guy. He's come back, and he's got his little place in comedy history." But he goes, "Just think, if this place had a bomb go off in it right now, Joe Piscopo would go right to the top." It was like the 1990 comedy. It wasn't the Cable Ace, but it was some award. And you could tell he was kind of not really comfortable in his own skin up there because he was getting some award. But Gary Shandling had come up, I think, right before. I don't know if you've heard this story. Gary Shandling drove all the way from where he was from, which is Tucson, Arizona, of all places, up to 3 hours away where George was performing before Gary even started comedy. It was in the Zen Diaries that Apatow put out. And how many comics of today would do this? He went, because most comics, before they do their show, they don't want to talk to anybody. So he approached George Carlin. He saw him at the club. And he said, could you look at some of my stuff? So he left all these yellow legal pad jokes and thoughts with Carlin. And so he come back the next night. He drove all the way home. I forget, where would Carlin have been playing in Arizona? It's maybe Tempe or whatever. But it was 3 hours. So he drove all the way home, drove back the next night or whenever Carlin said to come back. And Carlin had not only looked over the stuff, but he had redlined and notated and all this stuff.
Oh, wow.
I mean, who would do that? And Carlin was already probably, I could do the math and figure. I think Shandling had just gotten out of college, and Shandling was born in 49, so 59, 69. Yeah, it was probably around the time Carlin was already just transitioning into AM, FM, and Occupation Fool. So he put all in, he sat there and talked to Shandling for like an hour. He goes, "You got some good stuff here." He goes, "You got some good stuff. It's a little green. But I think if you were to pursue this, I think you'd have a career." And history showed that Carlin was right. And
yeah.
So I think Shandling brought him up on that awards show, having told that story. And then Carlin comes up, he goes, now I'm going to be seen as an actual nice guy, and not just the seven words you can't say on television. But that's kind of what he was. His daughter said that's what he was like, too. He really did have a heart, but he had that,
public persona.
But he had that thing all great comics need. He had that. That's what Seinfeld said once, too. A comic generally can't be a particularly happy person. They have to have some grist. You know, that's how the pearl is made, you know, in the shelf from all the grinding of the sand and stuff. He can't be a great comic. No great comic can be some happy-go-lucky guy who's just skipping down the lane, you know.
Yeah. But you were, when you talked about Gary Shandling coming from Tucson, mm-hmm. can I tell you a Tucson story?
I'll take any Tucson story.
I had one of my animated films in a film festival in Tucson. So,
cool.
So they put me up at this hotel, mm-hmm. and I wanted to get some film for my camera, and it was down at the bottom of the hill. And Tucson has the Kitt Peak Observatory.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have a city ordinance in Tucson, mm-hmm. that they can't have any street lights on at night, so you can see the stars really well.
Oh, cool.
So I was at the top of this hill at this hotel, and I had to walk down this winding road to get to the drugstore,
mm-hmm.
and I tripped a couple of times over a boulder and damn near fell headlong into a cactus.
Oh, my God.
And the only illumination was like when comes some headlights, the car would be squirreling around a curve. That was mm-hmm. the only illumination.
Right.
I figured out really fast that the Chamber of Commerce in Tucson makes sure one way or another in Tucson you're going to see stars.
Yeah. Oh, I hate that. That was one of your delayed punchlines.
Yeah.
That is good, though. I think my wife's has relatives that have a Tuller trophy. They have a guy had a trophy shop, and I want to say it's Tucson. I always remember because my friend Kelly, the first time he worked in Tucson, one of the MCs at this club we were working at, he pronounced it Tucson, because phonetically, I believe that's how it would be pronounced.
Here's
Kelly Bear from Tucson, Arizona. So if you ever ran into Tuller Trophy, one of my wife's relatives who not only won a pinball jackpot of thousands of dollars once, but he won the Arizona State Lottery at the time, which was close to $5 million. And he was already had his own business, was doing pretty well. He was, Milt Tuller. My wife's going to kill me because her grandfather was, let me think, I think it's Mort. Yeah, it was Mort Tuller. Funny guy. And I think his son still runs that. So a nice little ad for the Tuller Trophy from Tuck. On. Hey, when you were talking about, I wanted to run a couple of other animation things. When we were talking the other day, you said, didn't you? It was Tex Avery. Was he one of the last ones you kind of like after that?
Yeah, Tex Avery. When I worked at Hanna-Barbera, mm-hmm. That was the last year he was alive. I visited him in the hospital at St. Joseph's. He died of liver cancer. It was the same hospital that Disney died in. There was two in Hollywood. There's two mm-hmm. basic schools of animation. There's mm-hmm. the Disney school, very smooth and mm-hmm. cute, and then there's the Tex Avery school, which was just wacky character, just just everything in service of a gag.
Okay. Yeah. So, my kind of stuff.
Yeah, so he brought me into it. He only had one recurring character, which mm-hmm. is Droopy, the little short little dog. And he, hello, will you happy taxpayers? And Tex talked like that. He came to Texas,
the name of the character was Droopy Dog, right?
Droopy Dog, yeah.
He was kind of like Eeyore. He was kind of depressed or just down in the mouth.
But he was also always the winner, you know, the wolf's okay. trying to get him, and he's always the great big bulldog's trying to get him, and he's always screwing him over somehow. And very, very, very deadpan. He brought me into his office one time and drew me the difference between a Disney mouse and a Tex Avery mouse.
That's funny.
And,
What about did you ever run across Hal Smith, who was Otis the Drunk on, because I heard he did a million voices. He was Otis Campbell the Drunk.
Yeah, I saw him in the office one time at Hanna-Barbera. He was waiting to do some voices in the studio.
Because he was, you know, everybody always thought back in those days, and I've heard a lot of the PC people against PC saying, you know, there was a drunk in Andy Griffith Show. That's real life. Every town had my hometown had a town drunk, and he was cool because he put himself in the jail to sleep it off.
Oh yeah.
But he did like quite a few. When I looked at his IMDb page, he did like a million voices.
Yeah, I think that's what he did most of his voices, more than being on screen.
Right, because and once people hooked into those, you know, I didn't realize till, because I was always a fan of those shows. I forget what they call it. There's a name for a show where there's a universe of Petticoat Junction, Green Acres, and
crossover
Beverly Hillbillies, where in the universe all those shows exist in some kind of a triumvirate, if you would, you know, they all exist. So they would bring in, I loved when they'd bring Jethreen in. I wonder if Max Baer got extra money for having to play, because Jethreen was no beauty queen.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't realize too, because you being in animation and voiceover, I didn't realize that B. Benaderet, was that the lady I was, who did the Petticoat Junction. She was, there's old Joe. He's a moving kind of slow, right? She was, wasn't she the one that was in Petticoat Junction? The
yeah, she was in Petticoat Junction, and she was also the voice of Betty on the Flintstones.
But the saddest thing was, I didn't realize, and she was also Jethreen's mom or something like that. But I didn't realize that she died. The poor thing. She had done Jack. I think she was the neighbor on the old Jack Benny or the George Burns show. It was, she'd come over. I think it was the George Burns show. It was her and some other guy, and they'd always come over into the house. And so she died like 3 or 4 years in a Petticoat Junction. She was like maybe 50 years old. And so that's why they had to bring in another Betty Rubble. That's kind of sad. She finally got her own show that was going to be, you know, and she died during the run of Petticoat Junction. I had never realized that.
You know, the other thing about B. Benaderet that I just found out like a couple, 3 years ago was that I'm a big Bugs Bunny fan, and there's one that I, what the hell was it called? It was a little, no, it was anyone where Little Red Riding Hood, Little Red Riding Hare, I think it's called. And there's this Red Riding Hood has this just annoying voice. And I was always wondering who the hell did that voice. And it turns out that was one of B. Benaderet's very first voices.
Yeah, her and
she was Granny, Granny who was Tweety Bird's mom before June Foray was.
Yeah, and June Foray, I was just going to bring her up. She really was amazing. I mean, she was the Mel Blanc. I don't know that she did a million voices, but obviously the most famous one was on Bullwinkle. She did Natasha. Rocky. Oh yeah, she did not. But she did, didn't she do Rocky too?
Rocky and Natasha. And Natasha. Yeah.
I think she did, and I was looking her up too. She did weirdest thing. She did the voice. Remember that Twilight Zone? Well, it was called
Talking Tina.
The Witching Pool. Oh, yeah, Talking Tina. Remember that? It was always a creepy Twilight Zone where they went down into the pool of those two rich parents who were fighting and they hated each other. And they came up and it was Auntie. Remember that one? And there was this, they came up into this universe where this lady was frosting a cake and she loved all the kids. And you know, it's kind of got a questionable premise. But so one time I read, this is how deep, because you're like me. We've talked before about how deep we go into IMDb minutia. That during the time they were recording that scene by the pool where the two little girls, I think the little girl, she almost looked like the girl that was played out in the To Kill a Mockingbird. It might have been the same girl. Good little actress, the girl that played the little,
I think, know,
Gregory Peck's daughter. And I always remember how good she was, and that's like the only thing. But
she was a sister of a famous movie director too.
But she had a couple of lines, and during the day they were filming that scene by that pool, and the bewitching pool, I think it was. And I also think it was like one of the last, might have been the last, it was at least the last of a season. So anyway, some transformer, some turbine, some saw, some machinery messed up her vocal. So who came in to loop it was June Foray. June Foray looped that voice. I mean, that's you know, come on. Because that just shows you, they go, can we get June Foray in here? So that shows you how talented she was, you know. She was the Frank Welker of female.
They always had parties at the Christmas parties and stuff at the Cartoonist Union. One time I'm talking to this little lady for about an hour or so, a really nice lady. We're having a nice conversation. And some guy walks by and says, "Hi, June." June? Jesus Christ, for an hour I've been talking to Rocky the Flying Squirrel.
And God bless her. She lived to be 99 years old.
That's when you know that she's a great lady.
And she came on. She didn't want to go on Howard Stern back when Howard Stern was still Howard Stern. Because she, you know, like a lot of people, she respected her. She didn't want to malign any of the characters, you know, because she knew as soon as she went on that show, he'd be having, you know, Rocky and Bullwinkle having illicit sex or whatever. So I don't think she, I think maybe ultimately she finally went on, but I don't think she did. But there, I remember even Mr. Smith, Jonathan Harris from Lost in Space, they tried to get him to go on screen. He goes, no, it won't happen, not me. Nothing good will come of that. I used to love that guy.
The other connection, I think I was trying to get a job there one time, but I didn't get it. But right behind on Sunset Boulevard was the Bullwinkle Emporium,
right.
And they had a big statue of Rocky and Bullwinkle that rotated. Mm-hmm. And Jay Ward's wife ran that store, and in the back was where they still did the like Captain Crunch commercials.
Oh.
And I got to meet William Hertz, and he directed a lot of stuff for UPA and Jay Ward. And he told me that they farmed out all their animation to a place in Mexico City. I forgot the name of it.
But yeah, they did that for 1 or 2 years. I read the whole book on that, and it was inferior. So they regretted doing it. But you can tell those shows still because it was not, the sound was bad.
But William Hertz told me that they never had a shot that was longer than 6 seconds. So it wasn't on the screen long enough so you could tell how bad the animation was.
My wife and I bought my father-in-law. There's a coffee table book. I'll take a picture of it and show it to you. It has every episode. The book is about an inch and a half thick, and it's a huge, large, very large book, like a road atlas. It gives every, I think I want to say there was, I think it was like 265, but, you know, each episode was combined with, you know, all those other little Aesop's Fables and Fractured Flickers. But it says it has a date, and it has the running time. It has who all the characters were, the people doing the voices, and it shows the plot. It says extra things you may have missed. Each page, each two-page fold-out is one whole episode of the show with all the great characters that were on. One of my favorite ones was, remember the two, there was these two prairie dogs that kept giving a mule a exploding cigar. They go, hey, mule, you want a cigar? they weren't prairie dogs. What were they? Would have been. They would have been little something in the desert that lives under the desert. It wasn't a mole or a vole or a prairie dog, whatever, a weasel. Whatever they were, hey, mule. And every time it smoked, it, of course, it would explain. But it says it's just so great to see who did all those.
There's another great book called The Moose That Roared. It's about Jay Ward and Rocky Bullwinkle and George of the Jungle and Super Chicken and all that. There's a couple of gags I remember from Bullwinkle. That one was William Conrad was the narrator,
sure.
And he did it in a kind of upper register, so he didn't sound like canon, you know. And the sun sets slowly in the west, and the sun just sits there, and Bullwinkle standing there. And he's trying to give it the cue, and the sun sets slowly in the west. Still sits there, and the third time he says, and the sun sets slowly in the west, and then boom, just falls down like they just caught a rope or something on stage.
Brilliant.
And Bullwinkle turns around and says, "For a thumb, he isn't very bright."
Yeah, and they, Bill Scott, I read all that. Bill Scott only did it because they couldn't find, they just were in a rush to find somebody to do Bullwinkle, and he did a great Bullwinkle.
Yeah.
Nobody could have done it better.
Well, he was Dudley Do-Right, and he was also Mr. Peabody. The other gag that got me was they did a fractured fairy tale about Pinocchio, and Geppetto keeps saying, "Stay wood, boy, stay wood," and finally he turns into a real boy and then leaves Geppetto high and dry, and the last shot you see, and Geppetto kind of basically had a, they were doing an impersonation of Chico Marx.
Ah,
so the last scene you see is there's a whole table full of dummies, and he's hitting each one of the wooden dummies in the head with a mallet. First, the one that says, "How to give an ice cream a cone."
Yeah, that's funny because I listened to Gilbert Gottfried podcast a lot, and he said that Chico was basically doing the voice of an Italian guy his whole career. You know, hey, yeah. What's the matter? You, what are you talking about? And they were all, you know, very Jewish guys, and they said that I've listened. They did 400 of those. I probably listened to every one of them, and a lot of them more than once. I mean, they're kind of like my comedy therapy, just listening, because they had so many great guests on. But he said that the problem with what happened to those guys, that toward the end, it wasn't funny seeing Harpo. Harpo is an older man. He just looked like a homeless guy wearing a wig when he'd bop around. And Chico had gotten in so much trouble over the years. He was constantly having like affairs, and they'd go on the road, and he was shot once. They took him out of the act. He had to get healed of it. It's a wonder he lived as long as he did. But Groucho kind of was smart. He got that You Bet Your Life. And so he was on that show for like 14 years, you know. And he made a good living. He was making like $10,000 a show in the days when that was, guys didn't make that a year. And he brought Harpo on once when he wrote Harpo Speaks, but he was still honking the horn and, that act doesn't age well. It's like when the Three Stooges were old men and they were slapping each other.
Yeah, it was sad to watch them through slapstick then. Yeah. But you mentioned You Bet Your Life, but mm-hmm. Groucho had Peter Lorre on there one time.
Wow.
And he has a long interview with Peter Lorre, and he says, "Wow, you always play such horrible people, and but you're really a nice guy." And Peter Lorre says, "Be quiet! You're trying to take food from my baby's mouth."
Yeah, I think a lot of that was. I mean, just like Hollywood Squares, the questions were prearranged, but I think a lot of Groucho's, a lot of the best stuff was ad-libbed by Groucho on that. I mean, he had certain things, you know, he could go to, and he had maybe some pre-arranged stuff, but he was, I think it was Dick Cavett or somebody once said, because Groucho wasn't a happy guy. It's been pretty well documented. He said, "Every woman I marry becomes an alcoholic," you know, and he kind of had a sad life, but I've listened to Arthur Marx has been on some podcasts. That was his son who actually had a very good writing career. He wasn't just like a lot of people that are from nepotism. You know, they get a job as a, you know, key grip on a TV show. I mean, he was a writer on many television series, and he wrote books, but he wrote movies. He was on enough TV shows where you could tell this guy really knew how to write. And he kind of philosophically described in interviews, because he was kind of a mellow guy and a nice guy. He came to realize that it wasn't easy being Groucho Marx. Because I think it was Dick Cavett who said, Groucho Marx, it was sad because he's the only person in the world who couldn't appreciate the humor, who didn't have a Groucho Marx. You know, because Groucho made a lot of people laugh in his day. He made me laugh.
I was amazed at the things that they got past the censors in their early films, too.
Oh, God. I mean, brilliant. It's brilliant.
Oh, stuff. Hold me closer. If I was any closer, I'd be behind you.
Yeah, some of those lines in those films. I mean, just, and
Professor, you're so full of whimsy. Yes, I'm always like that after eating radishes.
Yeah, I remember watching Duck Soup and a lot of those movies with my best friend, Robbie Braunfield, when I was a kid. And the first time you see one of the original ones, you know, as they got older and they, you know, and Irving Thalberg died and they were cast in the glary, steely eyes of Louis B. Mayer, you know, in their heyday, you couldn't touch any of those movies. Those.
I like them better when they're at Paramount. It seems like they're, when they went over to MGM, they're almost like guest stars in their own movie.
Exactly right. Yeah, they were just mailing it in. Yeah. But
and I remember when I saw another MGM movie. It wasn't them, but it was a, I think it was Dinner at Eight. With all these very pretentious rich people having dinner. And all the time I was watching the movie, I was thinking, Jesus Christ, I hope sometime the Marx Brothers burst through the door.
Exactly right. Well, so Ham, is it hamination.com? Is that your website?
Yeah, hamination.com.
H-A-M-M-I-N-A-T-I-O-N. I had your IMDb page open here. So you've got the... Here's, I'm going to list off some of your filmography here that you've done. It's always good to hear that. Hell to Pay was just, it gives it as a 2021 voice director directed by Gina M. And that was a funny, if you're into funny little animated things, and it's I think it moves fast. It's very funny. It's got some great
characters. I'm working on another one. I got about 31 minutes done on the next one.
Damn.
And, the next one, this next one's for kids. Mm. It's called The Dream Hat. It's a fairy tale about this village where everybody works at this factory. And they work so hard they've forgotten how to dream. And their old man does the dreaming for them. And there's going to be seven.
The Dream Hat.
And Julie Newmar, who was the voice, or she was the Catwoman on Batman. Yeah.
Hubba Hubba.
She does a voice on it. She's the mother of the little boy. This is the star of the story. Mm-hmm. And I got, there'll be 17 original songs in there. Mm-hmm. I kind of call it my Yellow Submarine.
Oh my God. Yeah. Cause you were telling me before you used to do click tracks. Is that what you call them when they needed music on the Gumby movies?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I made sure they had the Gumby's band had a beat to it.
And you're kind of like me. I when I retired from teaching, I've been crawling back on stage doing stand up again. And it's in our blood, you know. Once you do it, and once you get that first, you know, taste of stand up on a stage. I know, guys. I talked to Jim Hope, who was a writer for years. He was a head writer on George Lopez's show. He wrote, you know, movies. He's kind of back doing stand-up again. It's just, once it's in your blood, there's nothing that can touch the immediate gratification of doing stand-up.
Yeah. Well, you control everything. Yeah. The other thing was, when I was a kid, my teachers in Seaside, Oregon, there's three things I like to do. One was, I was like a class clown, and so I like to do acting. Mm-hmm. The other thing was, I was drawing all the time. I was drawing comic books.
Sure.
And then when I'd go out and play, and I would always think like music, like when I was playing Cowboys, I was hearing the mood music in the background. Yeah. And so I wanted to play music, but they told me that you can only do one thing. You can't do everything.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I guess the teachers know what they're talking about. So I can only do one thing. So I was sitting there drawing one time, and I got, my mom had a Hammond organ in the corner of the living room, and I'm drawing away on this comic, and this tune goes through my head. I thought of the tune, and I think, well, go away, tune, because the teacher says I can only do one thing. I can only draw. The tune wouldn't go away, so I thought, well, Christ, I couldn't stand anymore. I had to go over on the Hammond organ to figure out what the tune was. And then when I was at the Hammond organ, I thought, well, the teacher says I can only do one thing, so I can't go back to drawing. And it was driving me crazy. I was tearing myself apart.
Mm-hmm.
And then I closed my eyes one day, and I kind of held my hands out, palm up, and I had drawing in one hand, and acting in another hand, and music in there, and I threw them all up in the air, and they all came down, adding up to animation, where you can do all that stuff in one thing.
Great. That's so cool. I love animation, and that's, I think it's, we can never get too much of it. I think it really, it's some of the best work that human beings have done and created for media, you know, for entertainment.
I recommend to anybody who's trying to figure out what they should do in life, figure out what is it, all the stuff you like.
Yeah.
what would it be like if you put it together? Maybe you'll come out with something brand new that nobody's seen before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, amen to that. Hey, man, it's been really great talking to you, Gene. I'm glad we only met. I mean, I want to say it was a couple months ago, maybe 6 months ago, and I've enjoyed chatting with you, and I hope to, you know, check in. We definitely hear back from you when the Dream Hat debuts, and I'll just chat with you whenever I feel like talking about all this stuff that we both love: animation, comedy, and life. You know, it's been a good chat. Stay on the phone after we. I'm going to cut the recording, but I want to.
Okay.
I want to ask you a few things off mic. All right. Okay. Thanks. I'm going to thank once again Gene Hamm, all the way from Novato, California, for coming on, catching up with comedians.